Hello, welcome to Tech Weekly. I'm Matt Wells. Alex Krotowski, your regular girl with a grip on technology, is away this week, so instead you have me, the man with his mind on the media. I present The Guardian's weekly media podcast, Media Talk, and increasingly the content of our two shows overlap as broadcasters struggle to come to terms with the digital age. That's the subject of our main interview this week. Ewan McIntosh from Channel 4's new £50 million digital project 4IP comes into the studio to tell us why Channel 4 is getting involved in something that isn't necessarily going to make TV. Later on in the podcast, we hear from MrLastMinute.com, Brent Hoberman. He's got a new web business and gives us his take on the industry at the moment, as well as suggesting what could be the best way to stop Google's inexorable rise and rise. And sandwiched between the two, Alex will be speaking to David Wortley, director of the Serious Games Institute. She'll be finding out what a serious game is. I thought all games were supposed to be fun. Hear how Guitar Hero can develop your sense of well-being. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. Now, Channel 4 celebrated its 25th anniversary late last year under something of a cloud after a year of scandal and shame. You remember there were rows over racism in Celebrity Big Brother, deception on Richard and Judy, and the great global warming swindle. Channel 4 was in something of a doghouse, to be quite honest. To reinvigorate the organisation, Channel 4 went back to its public service roots. It started making an attempt to redefine where it would be going in the next 25 years. And one part of these plans include 4 Innovation for the Public, or 4IP. Now, Ewan McIntosh is 4IP's Digital Commissioner for Scotland and Northern Ireland, and he came into the podcast studio earlier this week, just a couple of weeks into his new job at 4. He talked to our own Jemima Kish and Charles Arthur about the task ahead for the 4IP team, but Jemima started off their conversation by asking him to explain in a bit more detail what 4IP actually was.
4IP is straight out of the Next on 4 document that came out earlier this year, which set out where Channel 4 hopes to head for the next wee while. The main principle behind it is a little bit like Channel 4 back in the early 80s, looking to nurture new talent and find fresh ideas, but it's doing it in a 21st century way.
So what kind of companies are going to benefit from this? Because there's some amazing startup companies out there who I'm sure would love the chance to work with Channel 4. Is that what this is about?
Yeah, absolutely. 4IP is not anything to do with television. It's not a telefund. It's not really touching Channel 4's core business. It's trying to come up with new perspectives on that. That really opens the road for tech startups, ones that maybe have tools, for example, but are maybe they're missing some content, and that's where we can help build nice little partnerships.
So when we're talking about content, are we really talking about pushing TV programs out over the net, or are we talking about some way, for example, so that people in a community can create their own online TV station? What sort of...
I think of the two propositions you put forward, it's certainly not the first. It's the last one it would be the first. And the second is getting closer to it, but it's not about television. So it could be certainly co-creation of video is exciting and it's innovative, but is it always the best medium to get across the message we're trying to do? No. Sometimes it will be photography, sometimes it will be writing, other times it will be a service that's provided to help you discover your local area better, for example.
What's the purpose in Channel 4 doing this? I mean, isn't this done to some extent by all the big internet companies, by the, you know, your Yahoos with Flickr's, your YouTubes, which will let you upload videos or photos and create communities around those, which don't necessarily have to be geographical even. What is it that Channel 4 brings to the party that's special?
Channel 4 brings public service to it. It brings the notion that Yahoo is in there to make money. If there are public service outcomes from Flickr, for example, that's great, but it's not the principal desire. The principal desire is something else. Our principal desire is this is for public service broadcasting. It is to take a fresh look at the way public sector broadcasting looks when there is no television attached. So that's the unique thing that Channel 4 brings. The other thing is just the style of Channel 4. And the fact that it does do things differently, the whole set of values behind Channel 4 make it quite distinctive. The desire to do things first, the desire to make change in people's lives and change the way people think about things. And above all, this one, make trouble, which you can interpret in any way you want. But for indies and for tech startups, make trouble should be the blessing they've been looking for to
pretty
go
much,
and...
Yeah, pretty much written into the company motto.
Yeah, exactly.
It sounds quite theoretical almost, though, saying, you know, we're going to be exploring how a broadcaster prepares itself for a new era. But how practical is this going to be, and how's it going to work?
There'll be tangible projects online that you can take part in, that you can be part of. And we're going to start launching across the various nations and regions in mid-October. And from that point, you'll get a preview, a taste of the kind of projects that we're already undertaking. We've started with one or two launch projects. But what it turns out to be in practice is very much in the hands of the indies and the tech startups out there. There are people sitting on ideas. I was over at the tech startup pitching the other day, saw some very young Scottish companies. I mean, I'd argue they're not companies yet. They're students with ideas putting them forward. They've developed them to rough mocks, and they're fantastic. Now, realistically, what would happen to them is normally they'd be seen as, you know, wonderfully enthusiastic, great, now go get a job. We're not going to do that. We're going to maybe take one or two of those and do something with it. In Scotland, we have the advantage of having some money to actually invest as equity in companies. And we're interested in some, especially in tech startups, in new technologies that could help power some of the projects that we're going to undertake. So, there's nothing more practical than putting your money where your mouth is. If you want a taste of the kind of things that 4IP would be interested in doing, you could take a look at Battlefront, which the education team at Channel 4 came out with. Wonderful project where young people use the web for what it was made for, which is talking about and campaigning for issues they believe in on the web and gaining and gathering support through, in this case, Bebo. Now, there is a television programme attached to that, but arguably it stands alone. It doesn't necessarily need the television programme to be a success.
So the partnership sounds promising, but we're going to need some money. So how much money are we talking about here?
The whole 4IP fund is up to £50 million over the next couple of years. It's not all Channel 4 money. Channel 4 are going to be entering into partnership on every project. So when people come with an idea, there also has to be a notion, you know, what on the content level, what is the public good within this project? But there's also the question of, you know, are there any funding partners out there who would also stand to benefit from investing in this idea? The more partners brought on board, the better. And generally, the way it will work is, you know, about half will be funded by, in England, the Regional Development Agency, perhaps. Or in Scotland, that could be Scottish Enterprise, who've been working with us. Channel 4 and other private partners will make up the other 50%.
Ewan McIntosh, and you can find more about 4IP at 4ip.org.uk. Now, as I mentioned earlier, Alex is away. In fact, she's in the US following UK startups as they try to make their way in America, and we hope to bring you a bit more about that in the coming weeks on this podcast. But before she left these shores, she visited the Sirius Virtual Worlds Conference, which took place in Coventry last week. As well as presenting a talk there on her beloved virtual worlds, she met with another of the speakers, David Wortley, of the Sirius Games Institute. Now, serious gaming is tipped to be the next big genre of gaming, with companies like IBM and Microsoft ready to introduce them to business, and the US military and healthcare industries already using them. Important stuff indeed, then. But what Alex wanted to know from David was, when games are meant to be fun, what is a serious game?
Games are about fun, and serious games are good fun too. The point, the only difference is that the game is designed with a serious purpose in mind or a serious outcome.
What type of purpose? What type of...
Well, games that are designed to help people learn, games that are designed to put people into situations which are very difficult to create in the real world or very expensive to create in the real world, to be able to develop their skills. Those are just a couple of examples.
Who do people make them for?
They're made for people of all ages. It all depends on the type of application. They could be made for young people, for example, to increase awareness of diabetes and other conditions and to change behaviour. They can be made for older people, for example, to develop some of their mental skills. And they could be used for everyday citizens. Games like Flood Sim recently, where you get a chance to play the part of a flood czar and see the effect of your decisions if you screw up how you invest your money in flood defences.
Who paid for a game about being a flood czar?
It was a combination of the government, I believe, and Norwich Union. It was a gay online game, and you can see a visualisation of what London or some major cities would look like if they're flooded.
How does Britain fare in the serious games market? I mean, where is it in the international space?
It's very well recognised internationally. It has a good reputation, and more importantly, commercially, companies are doing business internationally.
It seems as well, though, that a lot of the games that you're talking about are simulations. They're uses of technology, primarily gaming technology, that would be very expensive to do in the real world. Are there other types of serious games that are out there?
A lot of the origin of serious games is to address that need. That's where the economics of it come, because if it's very expensive to train people, for example, dealing with a disaster on an oil rig or an explosion in the centre of London, you can't physically do many of these exercises, so you have to use virtual worlds to do that. As the cost of developing these games come down, then you will see them being applied to many more situations, and included in that I think you'll find things like social networking activities becoming more game-based or more game-like in the way that they work.
One thinks of game as, you know, collecting coins or achieving goals and this and that and the other. And I'm wondering what your personal definition of game is within this context.
Well, I think the definition of game is actually changing and being changed by technology. I try to think back to first principles and look back at a history of how we've used games to develop. And if you think about the Olympic Games, you think about games that school children play, hopscotch, all those kinds of things. Games are more than just about simulations. They are about training skills, training our body, developing relationships with other people, understanding how we relate to the outside world. And because the use of technology per se is only fairly recent in games, and it's fairly expensive up until now, we've only just begun to explore the potential of games to be able to use games for all the things that we've used them all through history. All of these you will see emerging in serious games and in electronic games in general.
But turning that on its head, there's a lot of controversy surrounding some of the content of the more traditional console PC gaming market. And so if you argue that people can learn from and can take away from games the training types of things, how can you then argue, if you do indeed argue, for the division between fantasy and reality in, say, some of the more violent games like Grand Theft Auto or beat-em-ups, etc., that have caused so much controversy?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And I remember hearing a radio interview not so long ago where they'd done some research into the impact of violent games. And they found that people who do play some of these violent games have a greater predilection to violent behaviour themselves. So I think social responsibility has to come into this in some way, and that's why I think it's really very important for the government to take an active role in the games industry. I don't mean by this censorship, but I mean positive encouragement of the development of games which have a positive impact on society rather than a negative one. And one example of that will be a project that's under discussion between ourselves and games developers in London.
Do you feel that serious games then are separate from the commercial games?
I don't. I don't think they should be separate from commercial games because I regard many commercial games as unexploited for their potential for serious purposes. I'm going to mention Guitar Hero again. I always mention it every time I do anything, but Guitar Hero game is a game for purely for entertainment. That's why it was developed. But for an old guy like me, I'm 59, you know, and I can't use the traditional games consoles very well. Having guitar in my hand suddenly gives me access to this technology. And in playing that game, I'm developing my hand-eye coordination, I'm developing my sense of well-being, I'm developing a competitive spirit to play against younger people in this game. So The boundaries are very blurred, and so what I would like to see is, can we use entertainment games for serious purposes? How do we do that? And when we're designing so-called serious games where you want a serious outcome, how can we make those as entertaining as possible and tap into people's real needs and desires?
And do you rock at Guitar Hero?
I rock, baby. You should see me tonight at the Serious Virtual Worlds conference. Dinner, I'll be there.
Rock on.
I'm sure he rocked the conference as well. That's David Wortley from the Serious Games Institute. When it comes to the web, Brent Hoberman really has seen it all. Together with Martha Lane Fox, he founded lastminute.com 10 years ago, just before the dot-com bubble burst. The business was one of the few to survive the calamity, and eventually Hoberman moved upstairs to become chairman of the company, as well as non-executive director of our very own Guardian Media Group. He's moved into a new area for his latest business. MyDeco.com is a site which offers advice on interior design and which partners with retailers to sell home furnishings. Because of his wealth of web experience, Brent Hoberman was the perfect person to speak at a digital conference organised by CNN last week. And Jemima Kish was on the platform asking the questions. She asked him about the MyDeco site, which includes technology from another one of his investments, Imagini. This claims to help you, quote, discover your unique visual DNA, whatever that is. And so he explained a bit about what the technology does.
It's a nice way of saying you can search and find out more about yourself by just answering these sort of pictorial questionnaires. And we've used it at MyDeco to find out what sort of style you are. And hotels.com or .co.uk have just launched it now to find out what sort of hotel you'd like to stay at when you go away for a weekend. It's trying to understand my persona, my life stage, all that sort of stuff, and not making me put in reams of boring detail. So that, I think, is fun because it's a new way of doing stuff.
And it's not owned by Google, which is...
And exactly, yes, yeah. And I think that when I look at any investment, absolutely, you're right, Google is the one. I always think, well, is Google going to do this? Is Google just going to eat their lunch?
Well, I mean, I did have a question about Google, which you can't really talk about anything in this area without mentioning. Can they be stopped?
Can they be stopped? I mean, I was disappointed to see the Microsoft Yahoo deal not go through, because I think anything that helps give a count of any force is good news for everyone. Whether one thinks they are totally benign today, that's fine, but they may not be forever. So I think so much market share and concentration, any startup wants to see more fragmentation. They've given us all an ecosystem to work with, which is great, but I think that the threat, I mean, I guess, where do people think they could be stopped? I guess there's still lots of money going into semantic search, and Google seems to be, from what I read, more of a skeptic on semantic search. So I don't know, if somebody can really make that work, then I guess that will negate the impact of PageRank, basically.
And now moving into web browsers with Chrome. Yeah. Do you think it's really going to take a significant market share away from Microsoft?
Well, I think it's interesting because Firefox has certainly done pretty well. I mean, to get 20%, and certainly in the office we all use Firefox just because it's better. So, you know, will Chrome be much better than Firefox? Well, maybe not, but will it have a great brand endorsement, which Firefox doesn't have? That may make it cool, you know, and I think that's the, and so I think that there is a real chance, and there is a large amount of people who are looking outside of the Microsoft family who want that. But I also think that there's the fact that Google, or the rumors are, they're going to be commercial about Chrome, that they're going to embed it in PCs and stuff like that, which obviously Firefox haven't got the commercial team really behind it to do. So I think you could see them.
Well, especially when they start embedding it with Android and then it's on everyone's mobile.
Yeah.
Okay, so the UK startup scene again. Can you kind of define the different characteristics of the UK and the US? I did note in an interview you said that you were working in the venture scene, I think, with your father in New York, and you didn't feel you could compete quite as much over there. You said, "I don't think I'm smarter than these people. It's not physically possible to work harder, so I'd better work in England, where they don't work as hard."
That's very true. Yeah, so that was when I was 20. I think I wasn't working with my father, but he helped me. No, I still think there's lots of valid points there. And I made a very conscious decision to work in the UK. And I did find, I was shocked the fact that all these people were, they weren't, didn't just go to Harvard or Stanford or whatever, they were all scholars at Harvard or Stanford. You know, they were seriously smart people who worked unbelievably hard. So there was no aspirational lifestyle in it for me. You know, I think you always got to have your boss and have an aspirational lifestyle. But so they didn't have that. So I thought, well, you know, if I can do this, then differentiation is a key thing. It was a key thing for startups and it's a key thing for where you work. So I do think, you know, in London in particular, you know, it's globalization, I think it's more global, I think there is more and more of a culture that we get Americanized in a positive sense, in that their people are starting to be ambitious, take risks. There still is not the close-knit ecosystem that there is in Silicon Valley. But I think the British startup scene is more vibrant than it has been for a long time. And there are, what we're also seeing is that there is a wave of second-generation internet entrepreneurs who come to London rather than the rest of Europe. They're mostly foreign. If you look at some of the big exit, Last.fm, Skype, et cetera, they're foreigners, but they come to London and they invest in the second generation internet entrepreneurs. One, because they feel they have to give something back, or they want to. Two, because they find it interesting. But there is that ecosystem that's building up.
So a few trends that are going on in the technology industry then. Both Facebook and Apple have had huge success building these platforms for applications, and then these very interesting ecosystems of startups spring up around that. What can media companies learn from that success?
Well, I think one of the really hard parts is being first really does matter. And I think particularly for many of these early apps, for MySpace and Bebo and stuff like that, and Facebook, it seems to me that it'd be interesting to see how much harder it is. What's your percentage chance of success now versus what it was if you'd gone in a year, 18 months ago? Yeah, increasingly people talk about these apps, they go for it and do it, but it's actually to get the virality now in an app is so much harder.
I just wanted to talk about mobile as well. It's always something that people mention when they talk about what the UK is really good at. What are your thoughts about the mobile scene and how much it's opening up, how much more mainstream mobile content is becoming?
Yeah, I mean, I still struggle when I try and think of a really great mobile app. I'm an advisor to one, which is a company called WorldMate, which is MobiMate, which is an interesting one, which is a great mobile app for travellers. And it's just really, I don't want to belittle it, but it's really just nice UI. You know, it's great UI, which makes a difference between finding out if your flight is late and going to find 10 links or just having it all there. So, you know, that one of these. I think the area of mobile that I think is most exciting, and there are now a lot of startups in the space, and it's actually linked into Wayne consequentially, is the Where Are You Now bit, which is the geospatial stuff on the mobile, which we launched. And, you know, I've got a history of being wrong in this, or early, I'd rather say. Lastminute.com launched a thing called Deal Finder, which is what people are still talking about now, which is find deals around you now on your mobile phone. And we launched it, I think, in 99 or 2000. And it just wasn't, but I'd always said to them, it was a gimmick because we didn't invest enough in it. It looked like a gimmick and it wasn't good enough. I think the interesting thing, what we're finding today, and it goes across the internet, general theme, is that lots of stuff that didn't work in 2000 is about to start working. You could say that for many, many areas. So a lot of VCs are dusting out those business plans from 2000 and repurposing them.
Brent Hoberman, and you can find out more about MyDeco at mydeco.com. That's all from our Lena episode of Tech Weekly this week. You will be comforted by the news that your regular presenters Alex Krotowski, Jemima Kish and Charles Arthur will all be back next week. Until then, you can find out about Media Talk at guardian.co.uk/mediatalk, and there are links to our Facebook, Flickr and blogs at guardian.co.uk/techweekly. This Thursday's tech section with the Guardian newspaper will be full. It's the biggest tech section yet, and it features the Cleantech 100, which is our list of the most promising European companies that might just end up saving the world. That was Tech Weekly. The producer was Scott Cawley. I'm Matt Wells. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.